University of New York, Queens, and is the author of 10 books on media, technology, and culture, including Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back, and Siberia, CY, Siberia, Life in the Trenches of Cyberspace. He's the recipient of the Marshall McLuhan Award from the Media Ecology Association, and his most recent documentary film, the fourth that he's made for the Frontline program, is entitled Generation Like, which I happened to see a couple of months ago in my living room in Ojai, California. It's very insightful about what life is like for teenagers now, who are very fixated and anxious about curating their web page, their website, and whether they're going to get a lot of likes or not, at a time when they should be expanding their social connections in a more real way. Anyway, Douglas Rushkoff is going to be speaking to us on Present Shock, Everything is Now.
So I'm honored to be here, especially among some of my my personal idols. I wish it was under better circumstances. I mean, we're not here celebrating the triumph of humanity, but the fears of what we're going to do. I've been working a long time on trying to figure out a way to separate the effects of technology from the effects of our society itself, our values. In other words, there are these technologies, and while I don't think technologies are neutral, I think that they're, some of them are kind of cool, yet there's this future that we seem to be building with them, or this way that we're using them, that's a little upsetting, you know? And it's real easy then to just get lumped in, oh, you're one of the tech-hater people, Luddite, horrible, red, whatever. Red, maybe, but the other stuff, I'm not so sure. And then, just a year or two ago, I was having a television moment where I got great clarity on what the problem is. And it was while I was watching with my wife this show called The Real Housewives of Orange County. And many of you probably, you know, you're not TV people, so you may don't know this show. It's from a genre called reality TV, which pretends to be about these real people in these situations. And The Real Housewives of Orange County is a show about these, you know, women kind of in their 40s and 50s who have meals together and have misunderstandings and then big fights. And I watched this show over a period of really a year or two, and from the perspective of a media theorist, which is what I am, a communications theorist, and I was trying to understand, why are these women having so many misunderstandings, right? Is it because, you know, they get paid better, the show gets better ratings if they're fighting? You know, maybe, but these are women from, you know, the same socioeconomic background, they're the same age, they speak the same language, they live in the same region, they wear the same clothing. They should, by all accounts, have more rapport, have better communication rather than worse. And then what I realized was that these women's their faces don't move appropriately to the things they're expressing. That these women, they've had so much plastic surgery and inject so much Botox into their faces that they can't make facial expressions that are consonant with the things they're saying. And so then there are these big misunderstandings. Like one of them says, oh, you know, my daughter's going in tomorrow for cancer testing. And then the other one says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And then they talk to the first one later, and she goes, I don't think she really cared. She didn't seem to be, she couldn't express that she cared. And from my perspective, what's going on here is a classic misapplication of technology. Right? These women are using state-of-the-art plastic surgery, Botox tools, in order to try to lock their faces down at age 29. And in doing so, they're making themselves unavailable to the moment that they're actually in. But they have these two different understandings of time, which the Greeks understood. One is called chronos, which is time on the clock. Right? What time did you crash the car? I crashed the car at 4:01. Right? There's this other time called kairos, which is a more of a human time, a kind of a readiness, the time that you actually live in. And what time do you tell Dad that you crashed the car? 4:17? No, you tell Dad you crashed the car after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills. Right? It's that kind of state of readiness or opportunity that only human beings can understand. And what these women have done is by trying to lock down Chronos at a certain moment, they've made themselves unavailable to Kairos, to their humanity, right? To the thing that actually makes them alive in the moment. Right? And I think that this is the mistake we've made with digital technology. The simplest way that I experienced it was when the internet first happened, back in the well, whole earth, you know, Mondo 2000 era of the net. The internet was something that made more time for us. Right? The way you conversed in an online bulletin board was you would turn on your computer, you would plug it into this thing called a modem. It was old school. You'd have a modem, it would dial into a server, you would download the conversation, you'd disconnect from the net, and then you'd read the conversation in your own time. And there could be someone that might be a winner on there, right? So you're gonna take your time before you respond. You take an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or all night, and you craft this perfect paragraph because you're gonna be participating with great minds, and you want to put your best foot forward. Then you log back in and you upload your paragraph or two of response, and perfectly edited zingers in there. You get it on there, and then you wait a day or two to see what people had to say about it. It was like chess by mail. And everybody sounded really smart on there because they did all that time shifting and time compression, because they used the net in the asynchronous stepped way that the net actually works. It's an asynchronous technology. It lives outside time. Email sits and waits for you. It's not like a phone that you have to answer in the moment, although now we have voicemail. So the internet was a place where people sounded smarter than they do in real life. Imagine that. And that's why people like me looked at the net and thought, wow, this is going to enhance humanity. This is going to augment what we can do. I can be smarter there than in real life because of my time compression. I can interact with smarter brains than I get to in real life because I can connect to the other nodes. But what did we do? You know, when the technology story really moved from the culture of human enhancement, from the kind of psychedelic, magical, Mondo 2000 world to the much more market-driven pages of Wired magazine, all of a sudden the internet was no longer a place that we were going to expand what it meant to be human, it was a place where we were going to save the Nasdaq Stock Exchange, which had been suffering since the biotech crash of 1987. So now these devices, these technologies, these applications had to somehow find a way to mine us for value, to extract value. We couldn't go to countries of little brown people and enslave them anymore, right? That colonization thing had stopped, and with it, the expansion of the economy seemed doomed. But we found a new territory in human attention, in human time. So we started to commodify, to mine human time for its value. And then the words that started to describe net development were things like stickiness and eyeball hours. Right? Wired magazine announced that we are living in an attention economy. We might have infinite real estate online, but there are only so many eyeball hours in a day. So the object of the game now was to extract those eyeball hours from people in terms of their attention. So we end up taking an asynchronous device like the internet and turning it into an always-on device like an iPhone. We strap the internet to our bodies and have the internet interrupt us every time someone does a Facebook update or tweets about us or sends us an email or wants our attention or an app wants to tell us that something new is going on. And we live in a state of perpetual emergency interruption that the only people who endured that before this were 911 operators or air traffic controllers. And they did it for only 4 hours at a time, and they got charged for it. And along with this state of constant interruption, we had the millennium, right? Like Dr. Winter was talking about. We had the Y2K bug, the seeming, we were so leaning forward in the late 1990s and speculating towards the dot-com boom and the infinite expansion of the economy, and this is gonna be great, don't worry, invest. Have irrational exuberance, it's all okay. We're all leaning forward into the future, and then the year 2000 comes, and it's like, well, now what? The stock market crashed 2 months into the year 2000 because we were no longer leaning forward into the future toward the millennium, but we were all presentists. Right? We had the Y2K bug, but did the planes fall out of the sky? No, in spite of the fact that KLM grounded their fleet because they were afraid that planes were going to come down and the computers could figure out the change in year. It didn't happen. Even 2012 didn't happen. What did happen was 9/11. What did happen was a sense of extreme discontinuity. This leaning forward that kept us in a kind of a narrative of an almost a triumphalist narrative collapsed. Right? We can't have a story anymore. Our stories don't work. We're not moving towards anything. We can't be goal-oriented, both because we're living in the constant interruption of digital media and because we've passed over a threshold. We've kind of gotten to Oz and are wondering, now what? So when the narrative collapses, we can't lean forward into anything, there's really two reactions to that. One is we move into a crisis control, right? Look at government. What does government do now? It responds to crises. It doesn't have a plan. There's no narrative. There's no thing that we want. We're just in crisis control or in a panic state. So what we do to get over this fear, this inability to move forward, is we give ourselves speed. We kind of go on Ritalin, right? And try to recreate that story on steroids. The political party, the religion. But those things, on a certain level, we can look at the collapse of narrative, not as a bad thing that we need to correct, but as kind of a good thing, as an interesting thing, or at least an appropriate thing for this age of humanity. I've never really liked movements. I think they were a great thing for the 20th century, but movements can be as much about great things as awful things. One day we could be walking arm in arm with Martin Luther King down Fifth Avenue, keeping our eyes on the prize, and the next we can be keeping our eyes on the prize as a way of justifying a whole bunch of awful acts. Well, if we just do these kind of terrible things, then we'll get to that. Every ism of the 20th century had the same goal-oriented journey in mind. It's difficult because we can't rally people around the idea, oh, we're going to go and stick a flag in the moon, and then when we've done it, we did it, we got there, yay! You can't rally people quite in the same way without that thing up there. But you can't rally people in quite the same way without that thing up there. You don't have people just marching behind a charismatic leader towards a goal they may not completely understand. And besides, I would argue that our problems today are not stick a flag in the moon, we've won, victory is ours kinds of problems. You can't land on an aircraft carrier and say, we won. There is nothing to win. Our problems now are not problems that you win. These are ongoing, chronic concerns. I don't think they're fixable in some false future, but rather the problems of sustainability. Life is not something, I solved life, now I'm just, what is that? Retirement? I solved life, I figured it out, I got the money, what did I do? It rings false to all of us, right? So instead of living these kind of book-like, movie-like lives, or going as a society towards some third act that we think, oh, that's when it's gonna happen, that thing, we start moving through life in a fashion in some ways more consonant with video gaming, with digital gaming. know, where instead of getting to some conclusion, we're making choices in real time. Instead of following some third character hero through his journey, we are that character making choices as we move towards what we think is better, towards our preferred future, or really our preferred present. You know, it's the difference between football, which is a game with one team and another team, they fight and there's a winner and a loser by the end of the game, and a fantasy role-playing game, where there's no winner or loser, there's no sides really. A fantasy role-playing game, you don't play in order to win and end the game, you play in order to figure out how to keep the game going. Right, the object of one of those games, of what we call an infinite game, is how long can we play? How interesting can this be? How long can we sustain this game? Right, which is a kind of place that seems much more relevant to a world that's not looking how do we win reality, but how do we keep reality going? You know, technologists should get this. But oddly enough, technologists and scientists and economists, they seem not to. You know, that my peers, when I do most of these kind of panels, my technologists, they're all looking forward to the singularity. Right? These are folks who can't bring themselves out of that 20th century or 13th century model of organizing the world. They still need to understand things as beginnings, middles, and endings. They still are so imprinted with the kind of the wrong lesson of Christianity, right? Which is that we're going to get to the end and have winners and losers, that there's some apocalypse, there's some moment to go towards that thing, the great orgasm at the end of time, when consciousness rises from matter. Right? They're focused on the singularity because they really want to transcend the human. Right? The singularity being the moment that technology surpasses us. And they believe that human beings at that point will only be valuable insofar as we can keep the machines going. But their understanding of the evolution of reality, really, is information is what is evolving towards greater states of complexity. So information, first it uses matter to get complex, then it uses biology, then it uses humans, and now information will use technology. It will use silicon. And we should shepherd it. Farewell, go, and be like Moses, and let information itself go into the land of Canaan without us. You know, something happened on the way from Mondo to Wired. On the way from Leary to Minsky, on the way from intelligence augmentation to artificial intelligence, where it was no longer about humans being at the center of this thing. And when I say that, they say to me, well, you just say that because you're a human. Like it's hubris or something. It's damn right I'm saying this, I'm a human. Of course, I am on team human. And I think it's okay to be on team human, especially if we're human. I do think human beings are special. But when I look at popular culture, what I see is the same kind of questioning about, are people special at all? You know, what is the zombie apocalypse, other than wish fulfillment for people who are just too tied to their phones? You know, it's a nice picture. You sit on a hilltop with a shotgun, get some slow-moving zombies, you got your family, you got your canned soup, and no electricity, no phones. But what is it beyond that? Beyond that, it's really asking us, what is the difference between a human being and a zombie, if anything? Right, we kill to eat, we walk around. I mean, they are us, and you always see those shots. You know, people are sort of looking at the zombies wondering, well, what's really the difference? We hunt, we kill, we hurt each other. There is a difference. There is a difference between people and zombies. People are alive. And even if we don't know the difference, that's mission enough to keep us going. What is life? What matters? What does it mean to be? What does it mean to be on team human? You know, we who live in the the real world, I would argue we have a home field advantage to the things that don't. You know, but and we who are on Team Human, looking for sustainable pathways for humanity to move forward, we are not the retro reactionaries. The reactionaries are the ones who are employing technology to somehow hold up the edifice of corporate capitalism. Right? There's not a coincidence that Kurzweil ends up at Google. Right? These are the folks who are trying to figure out how do we keep our valuations high? How do we keep the VC happy? How do we keep the market infinitely expanding? Right, the market infinitely expanding may not be the story we're looking at. The story we're looking at may be humanity sustaining itself in this contained biosphere. You know, the folks who are still addicted to Kronos, like those Real Housewives, you know, they are trying to lock down time in the 20th century. They're trying to lock down a banking system. They're trying to lock down a currency system. They're trying to lock down an expansionist model of society that requires more and more stuff in order to stay still. You know, Kairos, on the other hand, is for humans. The Kairos, the real time that people spend engaged with one another in the real world. And when we're doing that, when we're connected to other people in that space of Kairos and readiness, the systems can't actually touch us. Okay, thanks a lot.